then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's April the 16th, 2015. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, this being April the 16th, this is the closest RFN will get this year to the Führer's birthday on April the 20th. So technically, this should be our annual Führertag broadcast, and I will, in fact, play some National Socialist-style music on this episode, as well as an April 20th memorial on the Thought Crime blog. But I'm not going to make it a formal Hitler thing. I admit that down through the years, I've kind of let a lot of the customary formal observation and commemoration in our wee little movement subculture slide. The Führer's birthday, Commander Rockwell's birthday, and the anniversary of his assassination, the anniversary of Bob Matthews' death, the anniversary of Ruby Ridge, so forth and so on. Now, the reason for this is that I am frankly ashamed by the way we in our past several movement generations have let these truly great men down through our dysfunctional and immature behavior. The fact of the matter is that, by and large, we are unfit to carry on their legacy. I see very little point in commemorating these heroic figures from the past one day out of the year, and then acting like a bunch of spoiled, middle-aged adolescents who do nothing except tap on keyboards and show their butts on the internet for the other 364 days of the year. And my view of things is that when we as a group, as a community, display the type of profound moral courage and character that these great men made the cornerstone of their lives, when we come up to their standards in our personal and political behavior, when we lengthen our attention span to somewhat longer than that of a housefly, when we demonstrate that we are capable of maturity and forethought, idealism, and lifelong commitment to the 14 words, then we are morally entitled to commemorate the lives and deeds of these heroic men. Until such time as we can measure up to their demands of us in our lives and our behavior, for us to praise and eulogize them on their birthdays or death days and then spend the rest of the year acting like a bunch of 50-year-old teenaged horses patoots is a grotesque mockery, and would probably piss off these heroes if they were present among us to see it. Right, haven't answered a reader email for a while, so here goes. Now, this is from someone named Mark, and I've forgotten where he's from. Dear Harold, what is your opinion on Obama's nuclear deal with Iran? Why would the Jews allow the United States to permit Iran to build a nuclear weapon? Signed, Mark. Okay, Mark, to begin with, I think you're making a very common mistake here in our little subculture. You ask, why would the Jews allow thus and such? And implicit in the way you say that is this widespread, in fact, almost bedrock belief in our wee little movement that the enemy we are facing is this all-knowing, all-seeing, all-powerful monolith that rules the world from behind the scenes, pulls every string, and can do anything it wants. Now, that's what you might call the standard conspiratorial outlook, the idea that the world is all one big, huge conspiracy to get us, to cause us harassment and annoyance and suffering. Now, this simply isn't true. The entire cosmos is not one big, huge conspiracy on the part of everybody and everything to get you. In actual fact, the entire universe is one gigantic cosmic conspiracy to get me. And if you don't understand this, then you're paranoid. Okay, seriously, folks, the enemy we face is not an all-powerful and invincible monolith that cannot be defeated or at least gamed and manipulated even by little people like us. Powerful, yes, dangerous, definitely. An all-powerful and invincible and one single quantifiable conspiracy, no, and we need to learn all the ins and outs and nuances of that. We need to start dealing with things the way they really are. This is one reason that I keep advocating to our people that we become engaged with actual politics in this country instead of hiding behind our computers and just muttering to one another on the comment sections of our wee little blogs with the same 50 readers every week. Not to mention slandering and smearing and shouting down anyone like me who suggests that we peep out from behind the computers and actually take a few shaky steps back into the real world and real politics. Guys, the system and the establishment that we face has the largest degree of power and the most immense wealth in human history. Anytime you have that kind of power and wealth accumulated in any one social structure or government, you are going to have all kinds of ambitious individuals, factions, cliques, special interest groups, careerists looking to make a name for themselves, professional bureaucrats looking to build private empires like the FBI, parasites, hangers-on of various kinds, and just plain chancers who crawl over such a structure in and out, drawn to power and money like bees to a honeycomb, and every one of them out for himself and trying to make off with as much of the honey as possible. Now, this is one of the reasons that our Northwest Movement needs to start raising some significant money, so that we can start drawing some of these careerist chancers to our group and show them that if they join and back the party, they might have a chance at grabbing the gold ring someday. Although hopefully we can avoid the mistakes made by Pierce and the National Alliance, which is a whole nother story, so never mind. The liberal democratic establishment in this country, and indeed throughout the entire Western world, is not monolithic. Never mind all-powerful. The United States power structure in particular is corrupt, quavering with senility, riddled with intrigue and bitter factional infighting, hemorrhaging money and human resources and moral authority through a thousand rents and tears in its fabric, and it's filled with people and factions who hate one another's guts like polecats. Look at what happened to Hillary Clinton, who was once the absolute darling of the left-lib political establishment. Lefty-lib. Damn it, I say again, we really, really need to find some better and more appropriate term for the enemy we faced. Lefty-lib just doesn't cut it, not adequately. I know most people just say the Jews, but this is what I'm trying to tell you here. It's not just the Jews in the mix here. There are innumerable little permutations and factions and tendencies and interest groups within the power structure who make up the whole, and some of them are working at cross purposes with one another, but all of them are trying to grab the biggest share of the incredible wealth, which is still drained every year from what is basically the source of all the money in the world, the American taxpayer. Now, guys, many of us seem to have this image in our mind of a Protocols of Zion type thing where all the rabbis in the world get together in some kosher luxury hotel in Israel or New York once a year, and in a room lit by menorah candles, wearing their yarmulkes and their funny fur hats, they conspire together as to how they're going to destroy the white race for the next 12 months. It's not like that. There is not one big, huge conspiracy. There are 100, 1,000 smaller ones run by a really diverse group of people, if you'll pardon the expression. All interlocking in many ways, but based not on some grand blueprint of genocide. It is a conspiracy of consensus by a small clique of rich and powerful men who have decided that their best interests lie in taking certain courses of action. Most of it probably is not even ideologically motivated. It's money motivated. Anyway, where was I? Oh, yeah, Hillary. Okay, in 2008, the received wisdom was that the Sea Hag was supposed to descend from the heights of Olympus right into the Oval Office on a kind of roseate cloud without any rude interruptions. The anile John McCain was selected as her token Republican opponent to make sure she didn't have to put up with any annoyance or harassment on her triumphal progress as she strolled down Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House. But what happened in 2008? Clearly, some very high-powered people in the liberal Democrat hierarchy do not want a Hillary Clinton presidency. I think it's because they know her too well, and they're scared she'll use that power to settle all her many scores. So, all of a sudden, this high yellow mulatto red-bone nigger comes out of nowhere, a monkoid who has not even yet served a full term in the United States Senate, which the Hildebeest herself actually did. $500 million all of a sudden materializes in this coon's bank accounts off the internet, courtesy of George Soros, and I really would love to know what Hillary did to piss off George Soros. Okay, once again, I am rambling like hobo all over this without answering Mark's questions, and I apologize, so let me drag myself kicking and screaming back to the point. Mark, you want to know about the Iran deal? Why is Barry Satoro doing this? And why is he being, quote-unquote, allowed to get away with it, since in our 50-year-old worldview, the Jews see all, know all, and control everything with a single Yiddish whisper in the right ear? Ideologically speaking, you know, in our tiny little movement, we're still living in about 1960. Well, the first reason may well have something to do with the fact that our dictator is a secret Muslim, although actually it's not so secret at all, since under Muslim religious law, since Barack Obama's father was a Muslim, Barry is considered by the imams and whatnot to be a Muslim as well. Well, that's one of our paranoid conspiracy theories, which may well have a grounding in fact. I mean, my God, the nigga was educated, if that's the term, in a madrasa in Indonesia. But I suspect that whatever Barry's true religion is, he doesn't practice it much. Like all Democrats, his true religion is money and power, and control over the lives of others. But what appears to have happened, I say appears just to my observation, is that the true powers that be in the world, the faceless and soulless men in very expensive suits who meet quietly in boardrooms and exclusive private retreats around the world, many of whom I admit are Jewish, like Soros, but whose true allegiance is always to money and power. Anyway, these faceless and soulless men have created a new consensus among themselves and accepted a nuclear Iran as a fact of life, largely because the West now no longer has the military capacity to prevent it. The United States and NATO have frittered away all of their best military machinery and personnel in the deserts of Iraq and Libya and the mountains of Afghanistan. And so these secret figures in the power structure calculate they better make a virtue out of a necessity and bring Iran into the club in an orderly way. Now, this leads up to another theory I have, and this is going to get me into a lot of trouble. Because what I am about to say here is purist movement blasphemy. And I will have all the conspiracy theorists shrieking like banshees and holding up crosses in my direction to ward off my wicked heresy. Basically, I don't think the Jews are anywhere near as powerful as they were 50 years ago. I think they're slipping. I believe that things have changed since 50 years ago, when the Jews in general and Israel in particular were riding high, wide, and handsome. Now, do you want to see an example of the Jews at the height of their power? Check out a movie from 1960 called Exodus, starring Paul Newman and Eva Marie Saint, and you will see some of the most nauseating, adoring, ass-kissing Jew propaganda ever made. This is how Israel was regarded back in the day. Those of you who are my age can recall a time when any public criticism of Israel at all from anyone simply didn't happen. It just didn't. There was no need even to suppress it in the media. It just didn't happen. At the public mention of Israel's name, there was applause and bending of the knee. Israelis of any kind who came over here were rock stars. It was simply accepted as part of the natural order of things that these creatures really were God's chosen people. No more. Even a lot of the dumb goyim have a bit of difficulty getting the image of Rachel Curry being run over by that bulldozer out of their mind. The times have changed, the situation has changed, and the power dynamics have changed. Now, I believe that at the very least, a significant section of the world's true ruling elite, the faceless and soulless men in expensive suits I mentioned, and yes, probably including some Jews, have finally decided that Israel is bad for business. That shitty little country, as one British diplomat called it, is a source of constant trouble and instability in the region that these men still need for most of our world energy that they can steal and sell. After 67 years, it still is not economically self-sufficient, and it has to be maintained on financial and logistic life support by the West. Israel embarrasses the power structure in this new technical age where there is a video camera on every smartphone by openly and blatantly slaughtering Muslims, including cute little brown kitties wearing white skull caps. And this upsets and confuses the pale blob whom it is still necessary for the power structure to control because of their productivity so that we can keep things running, so forth and so on. Now, I think a large part of the dynamic of coming years in geopolitics is going to be between this new faction among the world's ruling elite on the one hand, who have decided that Israel is bad for business and that Israel needs to be at least reined in and contained and made all soft and fuzzy, or possibly done away with altogether through what is called the one-state solution, i.e. let the Palestinians overwhelm the country legally with their fertile numbers like the Mexicans are overwhelming us, And on the other hand, the old hardline Republican neoconservative Protestant evangelical elements of the 700 Club variety, who genuinely believe that the state of Israel is the fulfillment of biblical prophecy, and we gotta kill them ragheads and provoke a nuclear war in the Middle East so Jesus will come back and touch his big toe on the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem and a great chasm will split open and 144,000 Jews will suddenly realize that Jesus is indeed the Messiah and they'll be saved and they'll go rushing into the chasm and then the Antichrist will blow up the world and blah 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 blah. And by the way, that is an actual theological movement in evangelical Protestantism that I just described. It's based on a book from 1970 called The Late Great Planet Earth. These people are called dispensationalists, and from 2000 to 2008, they were in the White House from jug ears on down. I suspect that a good part of that stupid Iraq war was an attempt on their part to make Jesus come back. And lest you Christians out there start getting all offended, don't worry, I'm not talking about or insulting Jesus. I'm talking about Jesus, and I think you know the difference. So, in final answer to Mark's question, I think it matters significantly less in the world today what the Jews want, or at least the Zionist faction among the Jews. I think after over 100 years of Zionism now, they finally got some opposition, and of course it's not coming from our weak and pathetic little movement, us white boys who are so... It's coming from other factions within the power structure, predominantly non-Jewish factions, who can at long last match them dollar for dollar, with the result that for the next few years, the Middle East is going to be an even more interesting place to watch than usual. Okay, first music break. I'm going to play for you now an oldie goldie called the Badenweiler March. This was Adolf Hitler's favorite march, I believe, because it was the official march from his old unit from World War I. And it was always played when the Führer himself was present or entered a room, kind of like a Nazi version of Hail to the Chief. We'll be right back.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to be continuing my discussion having to do with the history of National Socialism as we are in the month of April now. And I'm going to be discussing a book called The Hitler Salute. Now, this was written by Tilman Allert, and he is a professor of sociology and social psychology at the University of Frankfurt. And as such, he's interested in various greetings in different cultures and how the greeting is an offer, an acceptance, and a response. And it is also a potential moment of crisis, as it is a moment of uncertainty. Now, in Germany, in the various German societies, traditionally you had a lot of regional greetings. But in the late 19th century, you had the Romantics, and they were interested in German unity, and they tended to be critical of modern society and wanted a more authentic life. Traditionally, you've also had scouts, skiers, and hunters in Germany who would tend to greet each other saying Heil Deutschland. This tended to be more of a farewell than a greeting. With increasing modernity, you had interregional greetings like Guten Morgen and Guten Tag. These tended to be favored by Protestants who tended to see life as consisting of work and being very busy. You also had Catholics who would tend to favor Gruß Gott. And this reflected a Catholic interest in the transcendent presence. And you also had an expression in the 1920s that came about that was phrased with German greetings. In 1933, the Hitler salute was enforced, and it was well established by 1935, and it was required when the national anthem was played or when someone saw a Wehrmacht officer or passed a shrine. Now, ironically, this salute took much better in the North than it did in the South. This is very ironic when you consider that the movement was centered around Munich, but it's also ironic in the sense that you had a lot of Catholics in the South, and again, the greeting was much more like Gruß Gott in spirit than it was something like Guten Abend. But the author explains that with so many sites to salute in the South, you also had more opportunity to avoid saluting. This writer analyzes the salute, and he tends to see it as physically constraining and semantically odd. He questions, was it really a greeting? He wants to try and translate the phrase Heil Hitler, and he says that it may be understood as a phrase similar to God Save the Queen. It may mean that the greeter wishes Hitler health and therefore saying, may Hitler be healthy. And while this is possible, it really seems to be inadequate. Now, a far more plausible translation would be, in his name, may all be well. And this only works if his name is a source of timeless value and is not subject to human limitations. Now, we should understand here that to the Orthodox National Socialists, National Socialism is an eternal creed. So it's not just a good idea that somebody came up with. And maybe in another 10 years or 20 years, someone else will come up with another good idea. National Socialism is really, to the Orthodox, the eternal, natural way. So that idea of Sanatana Dharma, quite literally. This stiffening of the arm and the body and the solemnity and the rigid concentration really make this a military-style salute. However, it was not adopted by the Wehrmacht until 1944, after the assassination attempt that took place in July. This salute could be seen as serving as a type of oath. However, the author notes that it was done again and again, unlike most oaths. The author notes that while Hitler would raise his hand to acknowledge this prayer or oath, he did not stiffen as he had no need to pledge to himself. To really analyze this salute, the author comes to the conclusion that its function as a greeting is best explained as a sympathetic rite that is seen in pre-modern segmentary societies where you have these relatively small autonomous groups that come together and form larger groups, and this may appear to be a community. It does tend to be somewhat dependent, but also in some ways its members tend to be rather isolated. This really sounds like us. I mean, I think of the lyrics to On My Own by Saga. At this point, individual identities are being militarized and subordinated into a hierarchy. There is this hope for salvation in an archaic form, but it also represents radical modernity. Just like in the pre-modern societies, the greeting brought together groups that were different, but it conveyed unity to the outside and it reaffirmed leadership. This caused people to have an otherworldly and transcendent closeness to their leader, and they saw themselves as tools for his will. Now, people came to the religious belief that loyalty was duty, and they were living in a sacred reality, so they had a change in beliefs and actions. Now, the book does go into some barriers in German society that this extraordinary declaration worked to overcome or transcend. Christianity was a barrier, really. Both Protestants and Catholics, they saw the world as in need of redemption and life as a time of trial. And, of course, they both put the church and Christianity on a very high pedestal. Now, granted, there were differences over the place of conscience. Catholics went more by moral decrees and Protestants more by individual conscience. Still, a very strong possible counterpoint. Next, you had the Weimarkt. They had their own traditions, and for a long time, these were considered sufficient until 1944, when they had a possible crisis of loyalty. The third barrier in German society was the family. Some actually just retreated into family life. But there were others that wanted to distance themselves from their family, and they wanted to live in a utopia where they were not burdened by social alliances. Now, of course, in my opinion, loyalty to National Socialism could actually be an extension of family loyalty, and really that would be true for any European. Another factor in German society was class. German society was traditionally very stratified. One of the things that the lower classes really loved about the salute was that it did away with social conventions. And the upper classes tended to have a strong military background, and they could be in some ways very independent, but they were predisposed to a military aspect. Now, the bourgeois had the hardest time. They wanted to hold on to a sense of power, and it's also interesting to note that for all Germans, especially the very folkish, folk-oriented, they were concerned that the salute was too Italianate. Although this eventually became a moot point, it was a concern for a time. Alert tends to be very critical of the idea of a sacred society because even though there was a strong sense of mission, social obligations tended to fall away. And the author is very concerned about this as he is not a fan of the salute. But I still thought that I would discuss this book because the author has some very fascinating insights into this gesture that we often do not analyze, but I thought that I would review this book because I would say the insights are valuable and really ultimately fascinating. So I hope you enjoyed this review and have a good evening and hail victory, comrades.
Greetings, comrades. This is a trucker coming at you from Fernley, Nevada. Got a delivery tonight over in Reno. And this is ways to tell when it's way past time to move or to migrate to the homeland. As Mr. Covington has put it in previous podcasts numerous times, go out in your backyard or patio or out the back door, or if you don't have one, out the front door or wherever at night and listen. And if you can hear the music of the jungle drums or the salsa music, or hear them out there bebopping down the street or whatever, you're in the wrong area. You need to move, migrate to the homeland. Another way to tell, growing up outside the Detroit area, we'd go down there occasionally, and the driving down the streets, you'd find pick-and-pull car lots with more parts on them, on the cars, than what you find on the streets, because they've all been field-stripped by the animals for their drugs or whatever. Another way to tell, look at the back end of the car in front of you. If there's no trunk lock or hatchback lock, yeah, they've been shopping. You're in the wrong area. It's time to move. Also, graffiti. If you got gang graffiti all over the place, yeah, you be in the wrong area. It's time to move. Another way to tell, bars on the windows of not only the establishments, the storefronts and stuff. I can understand that to a certain extent. But if you've got bars on the houses, yeah, wrong area, time to migrate. Also, if the houses have big anti-personnel fences up them, around them, I mean, yeah, I've got chain link fence around my front yard and backyard, but that's to keep the trucker doggy in the yard so he doesn't go out there chasing the neighborhood cats and squirrels and getting run over by a car. But there's no Constantina wire or razor ribbon on top of the fence, so it's just to keep the doggy in. Another way to tell, God, I hated going there, but occasionally I'd make the mistake when we were going into Newark, New Jersey, to pick up a load to take elsewhere in the country, and I'd forget to go and have enough food on the truck and wander down the street to the burger joint that, oh my God, it had bulletproof glass in between the customers and the employees. And they had a little tray that they go and put the food, bulletproof, that they go and put the food into and slide it out to you. So they did not have to come in contact with the customer. That was a frightening thing, yeah. Of course, the jungle bunnies down there didn't particularly care for the Rottweiler that I was walking around down there, so they kept their distance because, you know, it's not supposed to, like, illegal to have guns in New Jersey, pretty much, unless you have the permission slip. Speaking of permission slips, if you have to ask permission of anyone to go and buy a gun, like have to go and get a FOID card, a firearms owner's ID card, like in New York, New Jersey, Illinois, and whatever other states, Massachusetts, Connecticut, I'm not sure about them, but yeah, if you have to ask permission of the police department or anyone other than yourself to go and buy a firearm, you're living in the wrong area. It's time to migrate. So get in gear, folks. Whittle down your assets. Pack up the moving van or trailer or pods unit or whatever and get your ass out here to the Northwest where you're supposed to be. All right, this is the trucker signing off from Fernley, Nevada, for another little view from the windshield and tidbits from the road. Have a good one, comrades.
They say can do no. We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound, just watch a bandit run.
This is a very well-known song from one of the most famous movies ever made about World War II. The movie was The Battle of the Bulge, and the song is called Panzerlied.
Good morning and welcome. This is Mike Harris on Revolution Radio, and today is Friday, April 10th, 2015. And our guest today is author and social commentator Harold Covington. Harold, how are you, sir?
Well, I'm able to sit up and take a little nourishment from time to time.
Yeah, I just love that expression, being able to take nourishment. That's always a good thing.
Yeah.
So I've been watching your email traffic, and I've been watching your newsletters and stuff. And it seems, you know, why don't you just give us an update on the Northwest Front and where they're going?
Okay. For various reasons I won't get into, I have for a long time not been able to fully participate in the legal sense in various things. That situation has now been relieved. And basically my attitude, and I think the attitude of a lot of people, is it's time we finally just said to hell with it and try to get this show on the road. We are beginning the steps to create a formal organization. Now, for many years, I was against this. I still have reservations about it, but it seems to be what is expected of us. I have spent many years, and I'll be honest, this probably was an error on my part, trying to get white Americans to respond to our message in the same way that early 20th century Europeans responded to the political messages of their time, and it just doesn't work. We're dealing with two different animals here, and I finally have kind of raised the white flag on that. Americans have a whole different outlook. I think you may have gathered over my past appearances on your show that my general opinion of white Americans is not very high, and I think that's justified as compared to, say, our great-grandfathers. White Americans today basically was raised as a consumer animal, and he is not so much a participant in the political process as he is a smart shopper from his point of view. And as cynical and grotesque as this may sound, I believe that the white nationalist movement as a whole needs to improve our marketing, because we have to basically start tailoring our message and our activities and our presentation to the type of people that realistically we have to recruit. I've kind of given up on waiting for the rich men among us, and there are some, to step forward and be willing to finance a proper white nationalist resistance movement, either us or anybody else for that matter. I used to have this fantasy that one day there'd be a knock on the door, and I'd open the door, and there'd be this little old man outside says, "Hey, young feller, I like the cut of your jib, racially speaking. Here's a little something to help you move things along." And he'd hand me a check for $1 million. And it's pretty obvious that that's not going to happen. So what the Northwest Front's going to be doing is we're going to be actually building a formal donor base, if you want to call it that. I won't get into all the details. This will be the first step towards something which might be called Northwest Front membership. Now, I have always been against that, especially since my experience in the John Hinckley incident in 1981, where this Looney Tune shot the President of the United States, and in his wallet was his NSPA membership card signed by me. So that kind of put me off membership cards pretty much for the duration. Basically, we're formalizing, put it that way.
So let me get this straight. The John Hinckley who attempted to assassinate Ronald Reagan, whose father was the best friend of George H.W. Bush, mm-hmm. had a membership card that had your signature on it in his wallet when he did the shooting?
Oh, yeah.
No wonder they watch you like a hawk.
Well, for about the first 2 days after that incident, the first thing I heard on the radio, on WQDR radio in Raleigh, was that Reagan had been shot by a man with quote-unquote American Nazi Party connection. That was all over the media for about 2 days. It shows you how efficiently they operated. We were bracing for Secret Service raids, et cetera, et cetera. It turned out it wasn't anything like that. I just got a call and was politely asked to come downtown to the federal building to talk to a Secret Service agent, which is weird, considering a guy had actually put a couple of bullet holes in the president. And, I mean, you would think that they would have been all over us, like white on rice. But about 2 days later, after the one photograph that I had of Hinckley at one of our meetings had been abstracted from my possession by a reporter whom I made the mistake of assuming was a friend, and that's a whole other story there. Anyway, all of a sudden, that whole thing just disappeared, and the Jodie Foster scenario took its place, and I think I'm not alone when I say that that whole business about this guy shoots the president to get the attention of a lesbian actress, it didn't fly. It still doesn't fly, and yet it was an interesting demonstration of just how efficiently this system can operate to sweep something under the rug if they want it done. And it's a lesson I've never forgotten. And like I say, I don't want to go off into a long digression about my wild and woolly youth, but the thing is that one of the lessons I learned from that was no membership cards, because you cannot control who gets hold of one of the damn things. And there have been other experiences I've had. Bear in mind, this was back in the days when I was still an Orthodox National Socialist, and we were wearing the costume and everything, and our cards had the swastika on it. And everybody seemed to want one. It was like a little toy they could go flash around in bars and whatnot, and they just caused all kinds of trouble. So there will never be such a thing as the Northwest Front membership card, but we now basically, again, I don't want to sit here and fill the whole thing in public. Most of this is for internal consumption only in our own circle, but the Northwest Front is beginning the process of transmuting into a proper party now. Anyway, that's basically the story there. And this is going to be an ongoing process. It's going to take a long time. It's not...
You know, why don't you tell people, because we have new listeners out there joining all the time, and not all of them have heard you before. So why don't we talk about what is the Northwest Front? What is the goal? What is the mission? Start from the beginning and pretend like nobody's ever heard you before.
Okay. The Northwest Front itself is what is loosely referred to in my Northwest novels as the party. It is, or will be, the party of Northwest Revolution, the Northwest Independence Movement, which will establish a sovereign white homeland here in the Pacific Northwest for white people. This will take place as part of a Soviet-style breakup of the United States of America, which is coming, and it's gotten to the point where even liberals, I think, to a large degree, if you read the left-wing blogosphere, realize that something like this is coming. I think the government definitely realizes it's coming. I'm sure you've seen these news stories about they're conducting these military exercises all over the country now in American towns where the military is being given, you know, practice runs at suppressing insurrections and little, you know, white towns in Kansas and Iowa and, you know, running Florida and all this sort of stuff. So it's not like this idea is in some way unique to me. This country has simply gotten to the point where, as W.B. Yeats said, things fall apart, the center cannot hold, and I am by no means the only one who recognizes this. There are other independence movements and various special interest groups in this country. The Hispanics, for example, are intent on creating something called Aztlan in the Southwest, and it looks like they're doing it. Hell, they already are doing it simply through voting with their feet and with their genitalia and with the wombs of their women. They are now the majority in California, certainly, and you're from Arizona. I don't know what the demographics are like in Arizona, but I understand it's pretty
good. Let me just say that since I first went to Arizona in the early 1970s to go to school at U of A in Tucson, which was at that time probably a 90-93% white town, we would see Hispanics, Mexicans, if you will, now and then, here and there, but they weren't the problem that they have become because of the massive immigration. And now Tucson is a majority Mexican city. You have to question whether it's still part of the USA at this point in time.
Well, it's not. It's part of Aztlan, creating their own nation.
And the border changes. I mean, I'm telling you, I mean, I know where the official border is. Spending the time I did in Pinal County, which is the county between Pima County, where Tucson is, and Maricopa County, where Phoenix is, that's cartel country. It may be American during the day, but at night, it's cartel country. I know this for a fact. I've been there.
Well, there are no more borders, at least no more southern borders. Barack Hussein Obama, on November 20th, 2014, in essence abolished the borders. He declared them open, and they've been open ever since. If you keep up with the news on Drudge Report and whatnot, there are, again, hundreds. It's just like they're just walking across. There's no more even an attempted enforcement of any immigration laws, unless, of course, you have a white skin. So, in essence, on that date, November 20th, 2014, remember that date when he legalized allegedly 5 million, now it turns out to be more like about 30 million, but on that day, America became a dictatorship, a monarchy, because we have a third world despot in charge who was ruling by decree without even the pretense of consultation with the people's elected representatives anymore. And so the Hispanics, frankly, have succeeded in doing what we want to do here in the Northwest. And when the United States breaks up, as it will, they will more or less have their country, their little third world part of Latin America there, in existence, because the people and the language will be primarily Spanish and mestizo. What we're trying to do here in the Northwest, very much later, is create a situation where we're doing what they're doing, or what they did in the Southwest. We are changing the demographics of the Pacific Northwest by bringing in racially conscious, or at least conservative, white people. Now, the Northwest Front is bringing in a trickle of actual white nationalists, and that's increasing. We've had more people come in just since the beginning of the year, and we got some more coming over the summer, but it's just a trickle. What's happening in the Northwest is what we call organic migration. White people all over the country are just saying, to hell with this, I'm tired of living with all these Mongoloids in Baltimore, you know, burning the place down every night. I'm tired of living in Florida or Texas or Ohio, wherever they are. I'm tired of all the problems here. I'm tired of suddenly finding myself in a racial minority. And they're going to look around for some place to go, and right now the Pacific Northwest is still, with the exception of certain parts of New England, the whitest part of the country now, and they're just packing their U-Hauls, they're job hunting, and they're coming up here. There are people say, well, Harold, you're not having much success in bringing in migrants. Well, not from our tiny little movement, not that much, but what's happening is white people are doing what I want movement people to do. They are simply packing their gear and they're heading northwest on the interstate. And if you were to ask these organic migrants, as we call them, why they were doing this, most of them would probably use all the code words. nice schools, clean air, less corrupt politics, more comfortable lifestyle, etc. What they're really saying is we are tired of being surrounded by blacks and mud people. We are tired of the problems that blacks and mud people cause, and we want to live in an all-white community, an all-white world, and the Northwest is the closest place they can find that. So they're coming here. So just because getting our own wee little movement, getting our people to move here is like pulling teeth, does not mean that the migration itself is not taking place. It is. White people are coming here, and they're coming here for racial reasons. It's just a lot of them don't want to admit it. But that's what the Northwest Front is doing right now. We are going to be positioning ourselves as an actual revolutionary party or group or organization, if you must use that term, to take advantage of this. So to make sure that when those people arrive here, they've got somebody waiting for them.
Well, they do. And what I'm noticing here, I'm in Southern Oregon, you know, Ashland, which is we're only 11, 12 miles north of the California state line.
Right.
But this place is getting overrun by primarily white refugees from San Francisco.
Yeah. San Francisco is almost unlivable now. Unless you're a Google techie and you make $200,000 a year, you can't even afford the rent.
Well, that's exactly right. And so people are coming up here and they're buying rural property. And you'll see these Northern Californians, oh, they want their 100-acre piece, but they don't have a clue about what it takes to run a 100-acre piece of property, and they get over their heads really, really quickly. They're on a stiff learning curve.
Yeah.
And then so many of them are just so stupid, they shoot themselves in the foot because they come up here, and the first thing they want to say is, well, we need more diversity.
Mm.
Isn't that what you're fleeing from?
That's what you're running from, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, white people as a whole, okay, we've always had the tenderfoots and the stupid idiots like the gentleman at Jamestown, etc., who didn't get it and didn't want to work and so forth and thought they were just to pick up gold off the ground. But white people as a whole still have the genetic makeup that our ancestors have, and we can do pretty well on stiff learning curves so long as we are allowed to do it without constant interference from outside, in this case from the central government in Washington, D.C., and the media and the liberal power establishment. If we are allowed to continue with this organic migration, we can do it.
Let's talk about all of those things, the central government, the media, all of this, because all of those things, from my perspective, are controlled by something I've nicknamed the Khazarian Mafia.
Well, why don't you say Jews?
Well, you can, but you know, if you say Khazarian Mafia, they don't have the rebuttal of saying you're an anti-Semite. And so because Khazarians have no Semitic blood, so you disarm their best defense. You pull their teeth so they have nothing to bite you back with.
Well, this is to presume that any of this can be settled by argument or reason or logic or debate.
No, Harold, it's going to take men with guns.
Yeah, I know.
That is the sad reality.
I don't bother to debate with them anymore. I don't even try on the Internet. I can't remember the last time I was on the Internet and I actually tried to engage in any kind of debate with any of these people. Well, for one thing, they won't let me. I've noticed that most of our kind of people are now simply banned from the comments sections of major publications. And as a form of recreation, I wouldn't mind, say, debating with some of those jackasses on Salon Magazine just for fun. But the thing is, they wouldn't let me do it. They wouldn't allow me to register, and they just wouldn't post my comments. And the minute I posted an overtly racial comment, they'd probably just cancel my account. That's what's happened to me in the past. See, they don't want debate. They don't want argument. They want to shout their opposition down. That is not debate. And so as long as they have the bulk of the power, they're going to be able to do that. That's why I keep telling people it is useless to attempt to use democracy to bring about change in this country. The purpose of democracy is to prevent change, to make sure that the same group of people always have the purse strings and the power and the guns at their beck and call. I said in my last Northwest Observer, there are two ways in which, in a totally corrupt society like this, you can bring about change. You can use money, or you can use the gun. Now, we white nationalists are not competent to use the gun right now. My objection to attempting to use the gun to bring about change is simple. We would lose. It is not practical. And so, this is why I'm going into what I call my Jim Baker phase, trying to raise money, because we're going to have to try and do it with money.
darn, I miss that extra 8 or 10 minutes I could usually get before we got syndicated on All Nationalist Network, but the agreement was I keep it as close to an hour as I can, so I gotta stick with it. Anyway, for now, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sascha und der Bahn. Freedom. And for our closing number on this Hitler birthday week, this is Ian Stewart and Screwdriver.
He sat in a room in a square the color of blood. He'd rule the whole world if there was a way that he could. He'd sit and he'd stare at the minarets on top of the towers, for he was the beast as he hatched his new plans to gain power. In the snow fell, covering the dreams and ideals. And the snow fell, freezing the blood in the wheels. And the snow fell, they had to keep warm for survival. And the snow fell, and defeated the beast's only rivals. They took the old roads that Napoleon had taken before. They fought as the forces of light against the darkness in the holy war. One day they were looking out in the sunshine on the cornflowers. The next day they were freezing to death in the snow and the ice cold showers. As the snow fell, covering the dreams and ideals. As the snow fell, freezing the blood in the wheels. And the snow fell, they had to keep warm for survival. And the snow fell, and defeated the beast's only rivals. And then came the deadly road back on the steps of their retreat. The cold racked their bodies, but worse was the pain of defeat. And people who had hailed them once now turned and looked away. These people now knew that the beast was on his way. And the snow fell, covering the dreams and ideals. And the snow fell, freezing the blood and the wheels. And the snow fell, they had to keep warm for survival. And the snow fell, and defeated the beast's only rivals. The snow fell, freezing the blood in the wheels. And the snow fell, they had to keep warm for survival. And the snow fell, and defeated the beast's only rivals. And you finally came back to the borders of your fatherland. Now enemies came, traitors everywhere at hand. Many people had fought and died, knowing that they had to win. And still it sickens my heart to see the picture of the red flag in Berlin. And the snow fell, covering dreams and ideals. And the snow fell, freezing the blood on the wheels. And the snow fell, they had to keep warm for survival. And the snow fell and defeated the beast on their rival. Yeah, defeated the beast on their rival. Defeated the beast on their rival.